As mentioned at the outset, next week, Mitzvah Hashem Chanukah, Lashkicham Terasecha, notwithstanding, we will not be having a shir. We will meet Mitzvah Hashem 2 Mondays' time. And that means, for us, that with all that's going on in Parshas Vayeshev, our remarks this evening will be devoted to the days of Chanukah, for there is indeed much to say. As is our wont, we'll begin with matters of halacha and minhag, and then move from there to more thematic areas. And the practical aspect that I wanted to devote some time to this evening is one, of course, which is a central part of the mitzvah, namely a discussion of where to put the menorah. This is a discussion which probably could be best described as one that gets as complicated as you will allow it to. We will try not to allow it to get too complicated, rather present, if I may use the expression, some highlights. So the question of where to put the menorah is discussed very briefly, in fact, dealt with in 3 lines in the Gemara. In Masechet Shabbos, of course, Chanukah doesn't have its own Masechta or even its own chapter. It comes in Agav, almost, in the second perek of Masechet Shabbos, the perek of Bamei Madlikin, apropos of discussing how and what to light for Shabbos. We have the discussion of Ner Chanukah. And the Gemara quotes a Braisa, which is a teaching of Tanoim, which gives us 3 guidelines for where to put the menorah. Tanu Rabbanon, the rabbis learned. Ner Chanukah. Mitzvah lahanicha, the mitzvah is to place it al Pesach beiso mibachutz, on the entrance of the house towards the outside. There is further information that comes, actually, that where on the outside, specifically, as we know, it should be on the left side, so that one has the mezuzah on the right hand, and the menorah on the left, and as one walks through the doorway, one is mukaf b'mitzvahs, mesubah b'mitzvahs, surrounded by mitzvahs. That is why, if for whatever reason the doorway was not a mezuzah, the menorah would actually be on the right side, but of course the doorway should have a mezuzah. That's the mitzvah. However, says the Braisa, not everyone's accommodations allow for them to have this doorway arrangement. What if they live on the upper story of someone else's house? V'im hayadar ba'aliyah, if one lives on an upper floor, an upper story. So then, manicha al chalon hasamuch l'rishus harabim. You place it by the window that's facing the public thoroughfare, that's fine. You don't have a doorway to speak of that's really yours. You are subsumed within the lower floor. Put it by the window, and that's fine. And then, says the Braisa, Bishas Sakona, at a time of danger where it's dangerous to put it by the doorway or perhaps even by the window, Menicho al Shulchono Vidayo. Put it on your dining room table, and that's that. That's enough. So we have, to summarize, the mitzvah for a house, the protocol for someone who lives in an upper story, and then the procedure for Shas Sakon. And let us deal with them one by one. For we do see that if someone lives in a house, so he puts it in the words of the Braisa, al Pesach Habayis, by the doorway to the house. And here we should know that things are not as simple as they might seem. Although Rash says, doorway to the house means doorway to the house. However, it's often the case that the house is not immediately adjacent to the public thoroughfare. There could be a courtyard, there could be a front garden, there could be that type of area before one gets to the house. And in that case, where does one put the menorah? So Rashi says, always by the house. However, Tosfos, for various reasons, state no. It should always be the entrance that's closest to the public thoroughfare. If your house opens straight on to the public thoroughfare, So by the entrance to the house. But if there's some type of yard or courtyard or garden or such like, actually, says Tosfos, under those circumstances, you should not put it by the entrance to the house. You should put it by the entrance to the courtyard. So that's quite a statement. And we should know, for the record, that the Shulchan Aruch and Ramah, by his silence, his acquiescence, the Shulchan Aruch rules in accordance with Tosfos. That if there's a front garden, the menorah should actually be by the entrance to the garden, not by the entrance to the house. Here in Yerushalayim, most people live in apartment buildings, and the entrance is shared. Prizi, they partake of the second clause of the Brisa. They put it by the window that's facing the public thoroughfare, and that's them. The only possible alternative is to consider the entrance of the apartment building to be like the courtyard, in which case everyone should have the menorahs as you come into the building, and some people indeed do that, but certainly I believe the widespread custom is to have it by the window facing the public thoroughfare. Now, thus far, we have described what you could call the pure halacha. If it came straight from the page of the Gemara into our house, that's what it would look like. However, it is noted that in Chutz La'aretz, from many, many centuries, there is an established minhag to light inside. And this was noted by certain Rishonim, the Bala Itor and the Or Zeruah. They make note of this, that seemingly, even in times where there's no danger, but the minhag seem to err on the side of inside. And many Mefarshim and Poskim are looking to explain and provide a basis for those who always light inside, even if there's no apparent danger per se. And the justification or the establishment of this custom really takes two segments. The first important question is, we say that, strictly speaking, the menorah should be by the front door. If that's true, and a person, for whatever reason, didn't do that, has he fulfilled the mitzvah? That is the question. And really, the background to the question is, the third clause of the Brisa told us that in a time of danger, you can just light inside and you're fine. The question is, what does that third clause represent? Does that third clause represent essentially what we call b'di'evit? Meaning, if you lit inside, you're okay, so sometimes you have no choice. As if to say, a time of sakana is one of any number of b'di'evit situations, but this is the principle for all b'di'evit situations, including a person who just didn't light it by his front door, even if he should have. But b'di'evit, he's yotzeil, as we see in the ruling of Shasa Sakana. Or do we say no? Perhaps that ruling of a time of danger is a new scenario altogether, as if to say, if it's dangerous, everything changes. But do not make any equations or extrapolations from a time of danger to normal times. What's acceptable in a time of danger perhaps is completely unacceptable in normal times, and therefore even b'di'evit, one would not fulfill the mitzvah. That is the question. And here we see that opinions are divided amongst Rishonim. There are those, the Rashba and his school, who clearly indicate that the ruling for a time of danger really sets the tone for any b'di'evit situation. That means at the end of the day, even under normal circumstances, peaceful times, when you should light by the front door, but for whatever reason you didn't, and even if for no reason you didn't, you'll still always be yotze the mitzvah, at least b'di'evit. And in fact, perhaps it even depends how one intones the words mitzvah lehanicha a pesach beiso. One could translate that in one of two ways. One could either say mitzvah lehanicha, the mitzvah is to put it by the front door, in which case, that's the mitzvah. Or perhaps in a milder fashion, mitzvah lanicha means there is a mitzvah to put it by the front door. As if to say, there is a special thing to do, a special practice to put it by the front door. Of course, the actual mitzvah doesn't need that, but it's a hidur, almost. And according to these more lenient Rishonim, they read it the second way. There's a mitzvah to put it by the front door, and you should do it. But certainly, if one didn't, one still fulfills the mitzvah of Chanukah. As surely as, and I'm not sure if this is as well known, the Gemara also says there's a mitzvah to place the menorah at a height of less than 10 tvachim, which for us is approximately 80 centimeters. It should ideally be lower than 10 tvachim. Why? Because no one normally has a light that low, which serves the purpose of demonstrating that it's not really for normal purposes, but rather for the mitzvah. I don't think anyone would argue that if one placed one's menorah higher than 10 tvachim, then one wouldn't fulfill the mitzvah. He's missed out on that extra special quality of lower than 10 tvachim, but certainly the mitzvah is intact. That's the first school, the Rashba's school. However, from the words of the Rambam, we see a more stringent position. And the way this is derived from the Rambam doesn't talk about this explicitly, but the Rambam devotes two chapters of the Mishneh Torah to Chanukah. He wraps Chanukah and Purim together in four chapters, two each. He calls them Hilchos Chanukah Umigila. That's the title of the Rambam, which actually breeds its own question, because he refers to the set of halachas as Chanukah Umigila. That's slightly shatnas, because Chanukah is a time, and Megila is an object. Chanukah is a time when one lights the menorah, and the Megila is read on Purim. But the Rambam doesn't call it Hilchos Chanukah and Purim, and doesn't call it Hilchos Menorah and Megillah. He calls it Chanukah, the days, and Megillah, the object. That the Rambam is only to open his mouth, and already there's a scholar's discussion as to why he called it that. But in any event, chapters 3 and 4 are about Megillah. The Rambam first Chanukah. The Rambam first gives a general introduction of the story. And he tells the story of Chanukah, which is very interesting, being made by a Sheni. He tells all about the Greeks and all about the Hashmonaim and the background to Chanukah. And that itself is also interesting, as we've mentioned in the past, because the Rambam, for example, doesn't tell us the story of Purim. He just gets down to business. When do you read the Megillah? Why did he not tell us the story of Megillah, but tells us the story of Chanukah? So Rav Soloveitchik and others explain very simply. The Rambam, in his introduction to Mishneh Torah, stated that if you read the Tanakh and his Mishneh Torah, you basically know all you need to know in order to be a good Jew. You'll have the Tanakh and you'll have the Halacha. So, the story of Purim is in the Tanakh. The story of Chanukah isn't. And the Rambam has already taken achrayus that he's got to tell you between the two of them all you need to know. So the story of Megillah you can get from the Tanakh. The story of Chanukah, the Rambam has to give you himself, which he does. And therefore, he presents briefly the background, and then says, "Lefichach." Therefore, tiknu chachamim shebaoso ador shmonus yomim elo yimei simcha the halel umadlikim neiros al pesach habayis, and you light the lights by the entranceway to the house. Now, the reason why that's so significant is because that's the beginning of chapter 3. Now, chapter 3 is really deals with Hallel. The Rambam doesn't get to talk about the mitzvahs of menorah until chapter 4. Which means, why is he telling us details of the mitzvah of menorah in chapter 3, when he's not yet really discussing the menorah? Leave it till chapter 4, when he tells us all about it. But rather, as Mefarshim point out, the halachas of the menorah will come in chapter 4. But the Rambam is at the very least presenting the essential mitzvah. I mean, he's got to say something before he leaves the details for later. But what that means is if the Rambam mentioned the idea of the menorah being at the entrance to the house in his introductory characterization of the mitzvah, that tells you that this isn't, quote-unquote, just an added quality to the mitzvah. Placing the menorah by the entrance of the house is part and parcel of the mitzvah. That is the mitzvah. That's not a detail. Details will follow in the next chapter. And we see, therefore, from the Rambam that the placement of the menorah is critical. It's got to be by the entrance of the house, otherwise there's something missing from the mitzvah itself, perhaps the entire mitzvah. And the source of this dispute as to whether that placement is so important really comes down to the idea which we call persume nissa. As we know, lighting the menorah, it has that quality, persume nissa, publicizing the miracle. But the essential question is, how much is the aspect of publicizing the miracle endemic within the mitzvah, an integral part of the mitzvah, an intrinsic part of the mitzvah? Or how much would we say, well, it's a value in the mitzvah, but there exists a mitzvah beyond it, or before it, or beneath it? According to the Rambam, apparently, persume mitzvah, persume nisa, is the mitzvah. The mitzvah is to publicize the miracle. That's it. It's not an additional level of the mitzvah, or hopefully an outcome of the mitzvah. That is the mitzvah. And therefore, if that is the mitzvah, if you don't have that aspect of publicity because you lit inside as opposed to outside, so then you don't have the mitzvah at all. That's why he's so stringent. Whereas those who dispute the Rambam, the Rashba and others, they understand either that being mefarsim isn't a critical part of the mitzvah. Of course, it's an important part, but it's not. There is a mitzvah outside of it, the mitzvah to mark for oneself, perhaps, just like there's a mitzvah to read the Megillah on Purim, even if no one else is there. Perhaps they don't see persume nissa as such an intrinsic part of the nissa as part of the intrinsic part of the mitzvah. Or alternatively, it could be that they consider the people in the house who see the menorah, which of course they will if it's on the dining room table, maybe that's enough. Publicizing doesn't always need the public. Sometimes it's enough that one has family members and they see it, and that's enough. Perhaps they agree in principle one needs to display it, but it's enough ultimately to display it to one's family or those that are at home. And in fact, this very dispute we see echoed elsewhere with regards to the timing of the lighting. As we know, the Gemara tells us, you have a window, pardon the expression, in time for lighting, which is that half an hour from nightfall or whenever, that half an hour. And what if you missed that half an hour? Because that's the half an hour that everyone's wrapping up their business and they're going home and there's lots of passers toing and froing. What if you missed that first half an hour? The Rambam says, you've missed the mitzvah. And you'll spend the rest of the night doing tshuva for having missed the mitzvah of lighting the menorah, because it's that half an hour or nothing. Whereas others, the Rashba again says that's the ideal time, but if you miss the time, so then you really have the rest of the night until dawn of the next morning. And that's actually paskin by the Shulchan Aruch, b'di'evet. And once again, we see what seems to be exactly the same question being disputed. According to the Rambam, you need the public, which means you need that time that the public are there. And if they're not there, there's no point in lighting. Whereas according to the Rashba, ideally, the more public, the better. That first half an hour is the best time. But if something happened and one wasn't able to light during that time, certainly the mitzvah endures, once again, either for oneself or at least for everyone else at home. That's that discussion. And therefore, the way that we seem to paskan the halacha in the Shulchan Aruch is that one is yotze, the end of the day, if lit inside, even if you're meant to light outside. However, this is far from a justification, because in Chutz La'aretz, the established custom was, and in some places is, to light inside ab initio, lechatchila, not even to make an effort, seemingly, to light outside. One can't justify why people do things lechatchila by saying that you'd be yotze b'di'evet. There's still quite a gulf. And that's why there's still more to say. And Rav Moshe Sternbuch, in one of his earlier Sforim, the Moadim Uzmanim in Chelek Beis, so he provides the further piece here. And really the question is, that third clause, B'shas HaSakona, at a time of danger, one can light inside. What is the meaning of danger? When we see danger, we think danger to life, it's a terribly dangerous thing. But as we will see, there are many poskim, and Rishonim even, who have a much broader definition of danger. It seems from Rashi, in fact, that the definition of danger is not that there's danger of something terrible happening to the person who lights the menorah. There's very simply danger that the mitzvah won't be fulfilled. Rashi says, what's an example of Shasa Sakana? There was a Persian festival, she doesn't mention the name, but this is also referenced elsewhere in the Gemara in Gittin and Daf Yud Zayin, where it was somehow their festival of lights, and they decreed it was illegal for anyone to light lights anywhere else in town other than in their places of worship. And in fact, the Gemara in Gittin describes Torah discussion being conducted between various Amoraim, and in the middle it says the Persians came in and turned all the lights off because it was that festival, otherwise known as cultural sensitivity. So Rashi says that's a danger. But you see, no one was harmed, no one was arrested, no one was deported, no one was persecuted, but the lights were turned off. But on Hanukkah, you can't afford to do that. You can't put the lights in a place where there is a chance that they may get turned off. That's the danger, not a danger to life and limb, a danger to oil and wick. And therefore, and indeed we should know, some suggested that the reason why in Chutz Laaretz they lit inside it was because it's very difficult to light outside in winter conditions in Chutz Laaretz without something happening, without the wind blowing, without it getting rained on, and that's also danger, which the menorah will just go out. Rav Sternbruch is not that happy with that justification, because the implication is that wind and rain were invented in Chutz Laaretz. And do not exist in Eretz Yisrael, which anyone who just came to the shir will realize is not true. So that's always been there. The expectation is that one would make provisions. They had glass lamps also in the time of the Mishnah and the Gemara. So wind and rain are not enough. But sometimes it's just the passers-by or just those that are around. They would interfere somehow. In fact, you know, continuing this line, Rabbeinu Yerucham, one of the great Ashkenazi Rishonim at Talmud of the Rosh, describes that the minhag in his community was to light inside, because when they used to light outside, the goyim used to steal the menorahs. And the more of a hidur you made in the menorah, the less likely you were to see it within an hour's time. That's also sakana. You can't vouchsafe the fulfillment of the mitzvah. You leave it outside. You can't have a guard posted by every menorah. And if you leave it outside, you go indoors. And as it says in Iyov, Hasoif einechabov einenu, cast your eye away for a moment and it's gone. And therefore, we see that there was an atmosphere in Chutz La'aretz of disturbance, of interference. It wouldn't be that easy for them to light the menorah outside. And in fact, there is another type of disturbance which is mentioned by the Ritva. The Ritva, Rabbeinu Yom Tov Alashbili, Al-Sevili from Seville, and his words in the commentary of the Ritva was published relatively later, and therefore it's only more recently relative that we have his words. But we're commenting on Sakana, Perush. Lo sof davar sakonas nefashos. This doesn't mean danger to life. That's not what we're talking about. De'im kein pshita, because then it's obvious. I mean, no mitzvah does one have to fulfill. Certainly not the average mitzvah. And no positive mitzvah in the face of danger to life. Ela afilu sakonas tsar. Even if there will be antagonism, o eva, or ill will, kamo b'tsarfat, like in France. Now that was written a long time ago, and therefore, says the Ritva, you see that the concept of sakana is not just actual danger, but it will be difficult and there'll be disruptions, etc. And
it. What century was that actually?
Ritva was in the 1300s. So, it seems that this kind of characterized the atmosphere in many communities in Chutz La'aretz, and that became then the minhag, really just to light inside. Although, of course, Baruch Hashem, there's many communities now where they don't seem to have any of those problems. Ideally, the mitzvah remains for one who has a house to light at the entrance to the house or the entrance to the yard, as we saw. Now, coming back to apartment buildings, where things get a little bit more involved, we say, put it by the window. You live in an upper story, put it by the window. Now, the question is, how high can one live where this is still relevant? There's a very well-known halacha with regards to Ner Chanukah that if you put it higher than 20 amos, you're not yotzein. 20 amos, just under 10 meters, which would get you maybe three floors or so much. But there are some buildings where they go much higher. What about that? Higher than 20 amos? So Rav Shmuel Vosner, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, Bnei Brak, Shevet Halevi, says a fascinating thing. If you have a building that's high, chances are there are other buildings nearby which are also as high. Which means from street level, no one really looks up. But from all the buildings across, people do look out. Isn't that true? For some of them, it's a full-time occupation. But certainly, therefore it's visible. It's a fascinating because this is the beginning of what we would really call horizontal Pirsumei Nisa, even though vertically everyone is higher, right? Because the menorah is higher than 20 amos, but so are the onlookers, and Rav Vosner felt that was sufficient. It should still be put by the window. There's plenty of people all around. Not everyone agreed to that, but it's a very interesting svara. The final question with regards to... Yeah, you have 20 amos. Yeah, but if you're 21, so then the other buildings will be 18, 17. Yeah, okay, that's the price you pay. The final question, which is very interesting, we talk about Pirsumei Nisa, the passers-by. Do these passers-by need to be Jewish? And what's interesting about this question is... the half an hour that is described in the Gemara is achetichle regel min ashuk, until everyone leaves the shuk. But who stayed in the shuk for that half an hour? The Gemara says the Talmudai, the Talmudians, and they weren't Jewish, and they're the ones who were walking back and forth. They're the ones who were peddling their wares, and that's an interesting shaila as to whether there exists a concept Pirsumei Nisa if the person looking isn't himself celebrating Chanukah. Some say yes, you see from there, right? Whoever looks, let them see. Others say no, there's only a concept of Pirsumei Nisa with regards to Jews. When it says that there's Talmudaim out in that half an hour, what the Gemara means to say, if there's people selling in that half an hour, there'll probably be a few Jews still buying. That's how they explain that Gemara. So Taklis, a person finds himself, he's in the middle of nowhere, not a Jew to be seen, plenty of people, what should he do? But the recommendation is still to put it by the window for two reasons. Number one, because there are those who say that there's a concept of Pirsumei Nisa, even if those who pass by aren't Jewish. For number two, which is a very interesting svara, there's a very good chance that someone there is Jewish. Even in a place where no one's Jewish, someone will be Jewish. There'll be an Israeli who found his way into the middle of nowhere, and you never know what will happen if he sees a menorah. And therefore, if you're in a community... where no one is Jewish, that's actually quite a rare thing. You never know. In fact, if no one's Jewish, there will certainly be Jews there. So these are some of the major discussions. Of course, at the end of the day, everyone does Lefi Minhag Rabosov, Lefi Minhag Horov. But at least in terms of the background to the discussion with regards to the placement of the menorah. There, I'd like to move to some of the ideas of Chanukah and begin by expressing something which is somewhat puzzling from the Alanisim prayer that we say on Chanukah. As we know, there were two major miracles that happened on Chanukah. There's the miracle of the war, our struggle against Greece, our within context victory over them. And then, of course, there is the miracle with the oil, and no presentation of the story of Chanukah is complete without those two. And yet, against that background, we will note that on Hanukkah and Al HaNisim, we lay exclusive emphasis on one of those miracles, namely the miracle of the war. Rav Tois Rivam, Dan Tois Dinam, Marsar Tov Gibor Biad Chaloshe, and that's that. And we don't really tell about the story of the oil. And from a certain point of view, we can understand. Because of these two miracles, they're very different in nature. They're very different in purpose, even. Al HaNisim exists within the blessing of Hoda'ah, of thanksgiving, both in Shemona Esrei and in benching. In Shemona Esrei, it's after Modim. In benching, it's after Nodelecha. And the point is that we're giving Hoda'ah for the miracle. And Mefarshim point out, it's appropriate to thank Hashem for saving us on the battlefield. It's less appropriate, really, to thank Hashem for providing the miracle of the oil, because we weren't in danger in that sense, although in the loosest sense we were in danger of not being able to fulfill the mitzvah of the menorah, but we could still have fulfilled it with impure oil, which no doubt we would have done. I mean, that was a last-ditch attempt. We searched, we found that one pach of oil, had oil for one day, we lit it, and hoped for the best, and prayed for the best. But if that oil had gone out, there is no question that faced with the with light with impure oil or not, we would have lit with impure oil. And it's mutter, tumah hutribet zibur. Hashem provided a miracle, and we didn't have to do that. But He didn't save us in that way. And therefore, although we praise Hashem for that miracle, but it doesn't have that aspect of hoda'ah. Hodar is reserved for saving us from danger. That's the war. That makes perfect sense. Except the matter is a bit more complicated, because it's not entirely true that we don't mention the miracle of the oil in the Al HaNisim. We do, but in a way that actually makes it even worse. Because we say, Va'achakem ba'uvanecha, litvi be'secha, etc., etc., and v'hidliku neiros b'chatzros kodshecha. Hidliku neiros b'chatzros kodshecha. Anyone who sees that knows what we mean. That's the oil. Hidliku neiros. So we do mention it. But that doesn't help us. It only makes things worse. Because what a mention. Or more correctly, what a non-mention. That's got to be the biggest understatement in the entire prayer book. What happened on Hanukkah? We lit the menorah. That's it. Anything else? One day's worth of oil became 8 days. Isn't that what it's all about? We deal with it in such an offhand way. We lit the menorah. We haven't really done justice to the miracle at all. It would almost be better if we didn't mention it. Because talk about it like a mensch. And there was only tell the story, unless you don't want to tell the story, so don't tell the story. But this type of, with half a sentence, doesn't seem to be helping anyone. It's the equivalent of telling the story of the seventh day of Pesach as the day that we crossed the Yam Suf. That's not acceptable. I mean, cross the Yam Suf because it split open and we went through the middle? Yes. So you can't just say we crossed the Yam Suf. So what do we mean by this passing reference to Hidliku Neiros? Except, without presuming to account for the entirety of the ideological differences between Greece and Israel, which is a much broader discussion, but there's one point in the middle. And that is, it's the most fundamental question, really. Where is one looking to develop? Where is one looking to succeed? Where is one looking to invest one's energies? What defines good living? What should one be developing? For Greece, we see there was such an emphasis on the temporal, on the sensual, on that, on the empirical. There was no transcendent investment. And that's why there's such a pitted confrontation between them and Israel, because ironically, Israel endorses almost everything that Greece would develop, but never as an end unto itself, only ever as a means towards something higher. And that now becomes the point of confrontation. Is there something higher? Because as long as there is, it's more of a dismissal to adopt the other side, but keep it in its place, as opposed to just reject it completely. So beauty, for beauty's sake, and all these things, for all these things' sake, that's something which is unacceptable to Torah. But that's the prime area of investment for Greece. It's for this reason, in fact, that there's such, some Mefarshim say, there's such an emphasis on Hidur Mitzvah, on beauty within Hanukkah, the beautifying a mitzvah. It's way in excess of any other mitzvah. Hidur Mitzvah, normally you add on a little bit. Here it takes off entirely. The mitzvah is multiplied many times over, and it's got Hidur Mitzvah written all over it, because it's a statement about the role of Hidur. It's a statement about the purpose of beauty. It's there as a base to fulfill a mitzvah. That's the point where Israel stands firm. And moreover, Israel went to war over that, because Greece is looking to impose its own temporal vision of the world and cut out anything else. And at a certain point, that became unacceptable. And Baruch Hashem, within context, we succeeded in holding them at bay, driving them out, restoring some type of independence, and we won. But the question is, and this now becomes the critical question, when did we win? At what point could we say we have been victorious? You see, that itself is subject to a discussion as to how do you define victory. But your definition of victory will be an emanation of your definition of success generally. If it's all temporal, so then you will define victory when you beat the other side, in political terms purely, national terms purely. But if you do that, then you've abdicated on the reason that you went to war. As if to say, if Greece succeeds in getting us to define victory over them in their terms, then we have lost even as we beat them. And that is why we find something which is crucial. Chanukah Hei, on the very day that the battle ended and there was significant respite, the Acha Kein, straight to the Beis HaMikdash, to rededicate it, to restore it, to reinaugurate it, and to resume the Avodah. Because this isn't merely, quote-unquote, the idea of Zerizim Akdim and the mitzvahs, do mitzvahs as soon as you can. This was in order to give definition and give crystallization to the victory that we'd won. As if to say, all the Chashmonaim, that first generation Chashmonaim, Tzadikim, Tzadikei Elyon, Ramban says, the leaders, they cannot let that day end just having won on the battlefield. They needed to give it fulfillment. They needed to give it content and meaning. They went straight to the Beis HaMikdash. And in fact, I'll share with you a thought. I don't know if it's that well known. As we know, an idea that runs through Hanukkah is that of Mahadrin. There's the basic mitzvah, which almost no one does, because everyone is much higher than that. And then there's Mahadrin and Mahadrin Mina Mahadrin. These are concepts that exist only really purely in Hanukkah. And what is the meaning of the word Mahadrin? Well, the common notion is, and Rambam says this, so it's more than the common notion, there's a school of thought like this, that Mahadrin derives from the word Hidur, and it's about beautifying the mitzvah the way we said, and we explained it in that way. What's not so well known is Rashi's explanation of the word Mahadrin. According to, and this is Rashi in his commentary on Mechas Shabbos, Kaf Aleph Amud Beis, it's right there. According to Rashi, the word Mahadrin does not derive, it's not related to the word Hidur Mitzvah, it's not about beautifying a mitzvah. Not only is the word Mahadrin not related to the word Hidur, according to Rashi, the word Mahadrin is not even a Hebrew word. It's an Aramaic word. There's Aramaic in the Gemara. What is the meaning of the word Mahadrin? The word Hadar in Aramaic is the word for Lachzor, to return or to pursue. Hadar, like we say when we finish a Masechta, Hadranalach. Hadranalach means Nachzor Elecha, we'll come back. Hadar is Lachzor. And Mahadrin, says Rashi, is Mahadrin Acharei HaMitzvahs, those who are Chozrim Achar HaMitzvahs, people who pursue mitzvahs. As if to say, the basic mitzvah is just the one night, and then Mahadrin is more. So for Rashi, Mahadrin doesn't mean if you want to beautify the mitzvah, do more, but if you wish to pursue mitzvahs, there's more here for you. There's more light, there's a higher level of mitzvah, Mahadrin. Interestingly, why would there be a notion of pursuing mitzvahs embedded in Chanukah? Why is that such a thematic value to pursue mitzvahs? I believe the answer, based on our discussion, is because we are thereby emulating the Chashmonaim, because that's exactly what they did. They defeated Greece, or the Greeks there, and they immediately set out in pursuit of a mitzvah on that very day. They were the original Mahadrin, Mahadrin Achar HaMitzvahs. We're free! What can we do? What can we do with our freedom? How can we give it higher meaning? Where can we find a mitzvah? They made a beeline straight for the Beis HaMikdash. They were the original Mahadrin, and there's room to emulate them within the mitzvah of Chanukah. And therefore, if we come back to Alanisim, and we noted initially that we seem to focus almost exclusively on the war, because that's really what Alanisim is about, Hoda'ah for the war. But then we noted that we also refer to the lighting of the menorah, but not really, it's a half-hearted reference. Well, why not talk about it fully? But the explanation is, we're not talking about the miracle of the oil. That's not for Alanisim. We're talking about the war. So why do you mention lighting the menorah? We mention lighting the menorah as the culmination of the victory on the battlefield. As surely as the original Chashmonaim did not consider themselves victorious until they used it to do something higher, to light the menorah, they used freedom for higher purposes, and that's when they define themselves as victorious, that's how we refer to the victory. We thank Hashem for the war which led us all the way back to Hidliku Neiros B'chatzos Kodshecha. The miracle with the oil, that's for another time. That's for the Gemara, you'll hear all about it. But this is still the war. And moreover, we should note that not only did they mark their victory on that occasion by lighting the menorah, we do exactly the same. Every year, we mark their victory by lighting the menorah. The common notion is that the lighting of the menorah is to commemorate the miracle with the oil. It's certainly part of that because it happens for 8 days. But first and foremost, the lighting of the menorah, it should be noted, is not to commemorate the miracle of the oil, to commemorate the miracle on the battlefield. And the way that this can be demonstrated, even though it seems to be the other miracle, is the well-known fact that everyone is chayav in the mitzvah of Chanukah lights. Hakol chayavim, right? Men, women, that's a chiddush on an obligation level, because as we know, as a rule, mitzvahs aseh shezman kroma, time-bound mitzvahs, women are generally exempt. But there are exceptions, and Chanukah is one of them. And the reason why Chanukah is an exception is, in the well-known words of the Gemara, b'pnei she'af hein hayu be'oso hanes, because they were also in the miracle. There is a question, does that mean they were instrumental in the miracle, which would be a reference to Yehudis, who killed that general and started the whole thing off, or that part of it, or perhaps they partook of the miracle because they were also in danger at that time. But because, whatever it means, afin hayu ba'osu anes, that's why they have a mitzvah to light Chanukah lights. Now let's consider, women were not part of the miracle of the oil. I mean, that's basically Matasyahu and his sons, or Matasyahu wasn't alive by then, the remaining Chashmonaim, they came and they were not involved in the miracle of the oil. They were involved in the miracle of the war, in whatever capacity. And still we say there's a mitzvah for women to light the menorah, because they were also in that miracle. That tells us conclusively that the lighting of the menorah commemorates the miracle of the war. And why would we light the menorah to commemorate that victory? The answer is, we light the menorah to mark that victory for the very same reason that on the day itself, they marked the victory by using it to light the menorah. If that's how they registered their victory, that's how we commemorate it every year. And that's a statement about the definition of what it means to be victorious. And we should know further. Rabbeinu Bachya, in his work Kad HaKemach, which is actually a discussion that takes topics and goes according to the Aleph Beis, he's one of the first to do that. And he has a discussion of Ner Chanukah. And Rabbeinu Bachya says, note that Chanukah was instituted for 8 days. Now, of course, Hadera Chapshat, it's because it took them 8 days, the oil lasted for 8 days, even though that breeds the famous question, the miracle was 7 days, presumably, because there was enough for 1 day, and that can keep you going for 8 days itself. But Rabbeinu Bachya says, further in his discussion, Ki cheshbon shmone, when you see the number 8, it has a very great significance. Remez l'shemen ha-mashiach shehu al ma'alas shmona. The number 8 has an association with Mashiach. He quotes, and he describes very very generally, that 7 represents, in a sense, the normal running of the world as we know it, and then 8 is that level beyond, the betterment of the world. And he quotes a Gemara in Maseches Erechin, and Daf Yud Gimel Amud Aleph. And there, the Gemara says, Kinor shel mikdash, the harp in the Beis HaMikdash, shel shiva nimin haya, it has 7 strings. Shenemar, quotes the Pasuk, Sova samachos espanecha, Sova becomes sheva, v'shel yimos ha-mashiach, but in the days of Mashiach, says the Gemara, that harp, shmona, will have 8 strings. And Rabbeinu Bachya from there develops the idea that the 8 days of Chanukah are ultimately a preparation for Yemos HaMashiach. And these are his concluding words. Ha'inyan hazeh yesh lehisbonein. One should ponder this matter. B'shmonas hayomim ha'ela nikru Chanukah. These 8 days are called Chanukah. Inauguration. Induction. Which is Miloshen Chanoch Lanar, Kiloshen Chanukah Sabayis. We're introducing something, inaugurating something. Lefishuhu Romeis L'Shemen HaMashiach She'anu Asidim L'Chanech Beis HaMikdash. Chanukah is looked upon as the initial stage of the inauguration of the Beis HaMikdash in the future. And interestingly, we make reference to this, we just don't, if we stop to notice it. Because in Ma'oz Tzor, which was composed already in the times of the Rishonim, so at the end of the first stanza of Ma'oz Tzor, we say, Az Egmor, Bishir Mizmor, Chanukah Samizbeach. At that time, in the future, Yemos HaMashiach, then we will conclude Bishir Mizmor, Chanukah Samizbeach. If you talk about the future as concluding Chanukah Samizbeach, that means that it's, as far as you're concerned, it's a process that has already begun. And in the future it will be concluded. The question is, in what way, if we can try and get a more crystallized understanding, in what way would we say that Chanukah is the inauguration of Yemos HaMashiach? I mean, there's a long time between one and the other. Except, Reb David Cohen, Shlita, one of the Rosh Hashivas of Shivas Chevron, explains, we've discussed in many contexts that the tkufa of the second Beis HaMikdash was a very mixed tkufa in characterization, in profile. It wasn't pure Golus, because we were back, but it wasn't pure Geula, because from the outset there were many things that did not come back with us, and it was only a few, and the Gemara says the Shekhinah was missing, and there was no Aron Kodesh, and there was no Urim V'Tumim. It was very clearly a lower level than we originally had. And beginning with Rishonim, the famous Sefer Or Hashem, Rav Chisda ibn Kreskas, one of the great philosophers of the Rishonim, he explains that the role of the second Beis HaMikdash, although if anything could change, and it could have been, quote-unquote, upgraded at any time, But all things being equal, the role of the second Beis HaMikdash was to allow the Jewish people to endure the Golus for as long as the Golus would last. Because prior to that point, within 70 years, they had almost completely disappeared. As we know, the Jewish people go into Golus, into Babel. 70 years later, 40,000 or so come back. And even they are not in not such good shape, and they don't really know that much, and there's been a lot of intermarriage and ignorance. That's after 70 years. If the Golus remains, and it's meant to go for a lot longer, there's not going to be a Jewish people left. And therefore, the second Beis HaMikdash was almost like a in between. It's not pure Golus, but it allows the Jewish people to get themselves together, to give themselves the tools for Jewish identity, endurance, and continuation for the rest of the Golus. And that took place through a number of things. And what did the Anshei Knesset HaGadola say as soon as they came back? Hamidu Tamidim Harbeh, educate, everyone should know. Right, Torah should be the portion of everyone. Asus Siagla Torah. There should be boundaries in place that the people should have a sense of structure and of identity. And thanks to that Tkufa, it wasn't the final Geula, and maybe originally it wasn't meant to be. But it at least allows the Jewish people, when they go back into Golus, to stay the Jewish people, which they have until this time. Which means that a lot of what is happening during the time of the second Beis HaMikdash are basic themes and thoughts and concepts for the Jewish people in their Golus. When we had the miracle with the oil, so the menorah always teaches us, Eidus Shashchina Shorah BeYisrael. It's always, right, the miraculous way that the oil burns, which it used to even before Hanukkah. The Ner Maravi always burnt that way in a miraculous way. As the Gemara says, that's why it's called Eidus. It's a testimony that the Shekhinah is with the Jewish people. See, what the Jewish people had lost during those 70 years of Babel was a sense of the Shekhinah being with them. The notion was, we left Israel, God stayed behind in Israel, and here we are, and then we crumbled, and we disintegrated. The notion that when the Jewish people go into Golus, the Shekhinah goes into Golus with them, and is always with them. That's crucial for identity and for fortitude and for resolve and for continuation. Which means the full message of the miracle of Chanukah, which says the Shekhinah is always with you, even here, is not only even here, but wherever you are. And that's the gift of Chanukah, really. And that awareness will preserve the Jewish people. It's interesting, we say at the end of Maoz Tzor, well, depends where you end, but at the end of the original Maoz Tzor, Yevanim Nikvatsu Alai, ends with the words, B'nei Bina, Yemei Shmona, Kavu Shiru Anan. B'nei Bina, as people of Bina, of insight, they instituted 8 days. And Rav Cohen explains, Bina is always inferring that which is true from that which is stated. It's from the word Binyan, Bone, you deduce. And that's why the Chachamim at the time of Chanukah, they were B'nai Bina. They saw a message. The message is the Shekhinah is with you here. And then using Bina, they then deduced, if the Shekhinah is with us here, this is not really the full Geula, but the Shekhinah is with us, the message is surely the Shekhinah is with us everywhere. That's what they deduced. And because that's what they deduced, this is the beginning of the path that keeps the Jewish people firm and safe until the final Geula comes. And that's why Chanukah is 8 days. As B'nai Bina, Yemei Shmona. The number 8, as we saw from Rabbeinu Bachya, represents that level. Using Bina, they took this message as a way to get them there. And I'll conclude with a fascinating thought for one of the Hasidic greats, the Chedushi Harim, the first Rebbe of Gur. In true Hasidic style, he turns everything around. We mentioned that the menorah should be on the entrance to the house. That's how we began. HaPesach HaBayis. Where HaPesach HaBayis should be on the left side. Why? So the straightforward reason is, well, the mezuzah is on the right side, and then the menorah is on the left side. So when one goes through, one is surrounded by mitzvahs, which is a very wonderful thing. The Chiddush Harim says, actually, They're both on the right side. It just depends whether you're going into the house or out of the house. When you go into the house, the mezuzah is on your right side, and the menorah is on your left. But when you leave the house, the menorah is on your right side. But that's interesting, because that's what do you need on the right side? Your mezuzah for when you enter. What are you entering when you leave your house? When you leave your house, you're entering the world. But when you enter the world, you need a mezuzah for that as well. And that mezuzah is the menorah, because it contains a message. And the message is, Hashchina Shorah B'Yisrael. That's a reminder as you leave your house and go into the world. But how should you hold yourself? How should you carry yourself? How should you view yourself in that world? If you take the message of the menorah on your right side on the way out, so then your way is clear. As you have whatever dealings you do in that world, it's always with a sense of Shechina Shorah B'Yisrael. And if that message is kept with us, then indeed we have received from Hanukkah the path to bring us back all the way to Yemei Shmona, to Yemos HaMashiach, and if we stay firm on that, then every step we take is a step closer to that time. Ozek Mor, B'Shir Mizmor, Hanukkah Samizbeach. Wish you all a good Hanukkah.